Well, welcome to Dr. Frankenstein's Neighborhood Bible Club. Yes. Anyone willing to provide the crazy laugh to go with that? Okay, thank you. Somehow I thought we'd have someone.
We knew it would be Bobby, too.
That's right.
He said I was comic relief, remember?
And it's obviously a little bit of an unusual title for book chapter, the third chapter of Copernicus and the Jews. But the basic thesis of the chapter is stated in the subtitle: the Bible does not contain a New Testament or an Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And that may pose some problems for a number of people who have Bibles that consist exclusively of an Old Testament and a New Testament. So we'll talk about that, obviously, this evening. One of the points of the chapter is that these terms are simply inaccurate and should be discarded in favor of other more accurate terms. And a second point of the chapter is that this is actually an important difference. So even as last week we discussed the so what question, we'll try to discuss that this week as well. It doesn't make any difference, really, if you use these terms or not. What's the big deal? So that's what we're going to discuss a little bit later on. First, though, I'd like to ask someone to summarize in three sentences or less what we talked about last class. Just to make sure that we're all remembering everything we've learned.
That's right.
Okay.
That this, the Greek scriptures were written in a version of Greek that is not classical Greek and not even pronounced Koinonia Greek?
Koine, yeah.
But the proper name for, the best name for the kind of Greek that it is Jewish Greek. And that the Jewish Greek includes words that are either not used at all in the Greek language, such as transliterations of the Hebrew word, or that are used in the Greek language in a different way than the concept from the Hebrew language is.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else want to pick up on that? That was, I think, confined to three sentences.
It's not just words, but also phrases, you know, that are like we see reflected in the Tanakh. Mm-hmm. They bring them up in a Greek translation in the New Covenant.
Okay, thank you. Or to summarize, we could say that the writings about Yeshua, the scriptures about Yeshua, which Christians commonly call the New Testament, in the translations that we have in our various modern languages, all in some way translate incorrectly. And the reason for this is a misunderstanding of the original language of the text. So we talked about how the Septuagint was translated, the Greek translation of Tanakh, the manner in which it was translated, what the translators actually had to do to render Hebrew concepts in the Greek language, and how this actually created a kind of hybrid language. We also talked about how there are many such Jewish hybrid languages, Judeo-Greek, Judeo-Arabic, Judeo-Berber, and so forth. So we can place Jewish Greek in that context of broad historical trends. And we also started to talk a little bit about some of the changes in understanding or translation that result if, in fact, we treat the text as if it's written in a Jewish Greek language, as opposed to, let's say, a Christian Greek language, which didn't exist at the time. And if you missed some of the points from last time, you'll soon be able to check out the recording. I listened to the recording, and one of the disadvantages of doing that is that you can notice the mistakes that you make. So I'll point out a couple of small mistakes that I noticed. In our discussion of Sefer Toldot, which means what? Does anyone remember?
Book of Generations.
Mm-hmm. The Book of Generations. I was giving you some different examples, and I mentioned that in Genesis 2 it talks about Sefer Toldot HaShemayim V'Haaretz. This is almost correct. That's one of the cases in which it doesn't actually use the word Sefer. It says Ele Toldot HaShemayim V'Haaretz. These are the generations of the heaven and the earth. So it's the same concept, but I just wanted to mention that it's slightly different terminology there. Genesis 5 is one of the examples that actually does use the term Sefer Toldot. Also, there was a question last time about whether Yehoshua or Joshua was actually termed Mashiach, because we discussed how the high priests and the kings of Israel were termed Mashiach. I didn't find any place where he was actually termed that. Maybe someone else did. I don't know. Jackie, who asked the question, isn't here. So did anyone look into that question? Okay, so for the moment, we'll assume that he was not termed that. And that would seem to make sense. Any other mistakes, you'll have to catch on your own.
Question?
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying that David, Saul, and King Cyrus are the only ones that were called Mashiach?
No, absolutely not. Those are a few of the examples we gave. But for example, the high priests were termed Mashiach as well. Moses had to anoint Aaron with oil. So there were many, many examples. There was just
the Mashiach Adonai is taken away into exile, which means a king.
Yeah.
In Lamentations, it says Mashiach Adonai was taken into exile.
Who's talking about?
The Messiah, the Lord. It's talking about the king of Israel at that time.
It would be an interesting study to go through and see every place where it appears and who it refers to. But the point is that it was a word that had a physical and a broader meaning as well. And in the translation of the Septuagint, they chose to use a word that had approximately the same physical meaning and to add to that Greek word the extended meaning of the Hebrew, which would have to do with the anointing of God, as we understand it, God's authorization, God's power and bestowing of ability on a particular person to do a particular task. Well, again, if you are uncertain about some of those concepts, maybe we can return to them later, or you can check out the audio from last time. But today we have to deal with Dr. Frankenstein. And yes, you may feel free to add in your laughs each time he appears. It's an interesting title to a chapter, of course, and it begs the question, as with all of the other chapter titles in the book title, why such a title? And perhaps you have some thoughts on this. I'll give you an opportunity to talk about them later on. But actually, before class, one thing that I did was I actually looked at the actual Frankenstein, the novel, by Mary Shelley. And it's a very interesting book. I didn't reread it or anything before class, but I got as far as the epigraph, which is right at the beginning. And Mary Shelley was 18 years old when she wrote Frankenstein. And she chose the following passage for the epigraph. "Did I request thee, Maker, from my clay to mold me man? Did I solicit thee from darkness to promote me?" That's an excerpt from Milton's Paradise Lost, speaking about the creation of humanity. And the novel Frankenstein is similar in some ways. It's a story of a creator and a created being. And it's also a story of a created being that does not function in the way that the creator intended in the original creation. Now, there are some difficulties with comparing Dr. Frankenstein to God and Dr. Frankenstein's creations to God's creations. Most of those, of course, are just technical points. But nonetheless, there's some sort of comparison here. And this may help to explain some of the analogy in the chapter. In fact, if you remember the point about the Dr. Frankenstein Bible Club is that the attempt that's going to be made in this chapter is to connect your mind, your heart, our minds, our hearts, to a different set of wires so that they function differently than they have been, to make them beat in a different way. You may start to say things that don't make sense to other people, as it says on page 39. So, in other words, there's a comparison being drawn between what the Creator originally intended, how the Creator wants the created being to function, and how it actually does function. And somehow this is actually linked to the issue of a New Testament and an Old Testament. And it's also, of course, related to the point that my father makes in this chapter about this idea being sort of radical, not new, but sort of a dead issue, life from the dead, which is what Frankenstein is also about. Seems to be the creation of someone that doesn't really fit into society as we understand it today. Long dead issues that are being revived. So we'll see if that's a worthwhile endeavor or not. And I think it is. I just wanted to mention along the same lines that we should, of course, compare Isaiah 45 when we talk about that quote from Milton, and which is the same passage in which King Cyrus is termed anointed by God. But it contains this section where the prophet says, "Woe to the one quarreling with his fashioner or his maker. Will the clay say to the fashioner, 'What are you doing?' Woe to him who says to a father, 'What are you begetting?' or to a woman, 'What are you in labor with?'" So it's basically expressing the same thing that Milton expressed, except from God's perspective, saying that human beings should not adopt that attitude towards their Creator. They should not challenge the way that He would like to have life operate. They should not challenge the way that He would like to communicate His word and His design for humanity. Now this may seem a little bit far from the idea of Old Testament and New Testament, but I think it will become clearer as we go through the discussion. The link is that God has set up things and has expressed His ideas in one way in the Scriptures, but human beings have come up with all kinds of other ways to describe what they think are the same issues, but maybe actually very different. And as you've probably guessed by now, since we've gone through a couple of chapters, most of these decisions stem ultimately, or most of these differences stem ultimately from a conscious decision to depart from God's word as it was written. And the most striking instance of this for our purposes is, of course, the decision to de-Judaize Christianity as it was seen. Well, this was a conscious decision, and it was a decision that was definitely in opposition to the entire Scriptures. So it had some very significant consequences. One of the consequences would be a snowball effect, so that in later generations, even people who were well-intentioned would communicate in a wrong manner from within the new system that was created. And as Jackie expressed it very well last time, they would communicate a different text than actually existed. They would create a different text than was actually there. And that's part of what happens with the idea of a New Testament and an Old Testament. Okay, any general thoughts at this point, or questions, observations?
Well, I noticed the difference. The quote, the part of Jeremiah that was repeated in Hebrews, mm-hmm. I noticed an important difference. I don't have it in front of me, but I can find it. I guess it was Jeremiah 31 to 32.
Mm-hmm. Page 40 at the top, second paragraph.
Right. Well, but I think, well, I was looking at the Bible and I was reading a little bit ahead, and I found a difference that I don't think the book mentioned, but I thought it was a significant difference. Not to go on.
Okay, no, actually, one of the things I had for us to do next was to read the portion about the new covenant in Jeremiah 31. So it's actually relevant. If you could even just read that passage in Jeremiah 31 if you like, and then you could tell us what you saw that was different or that seemed different.
Okay.
And
this is the
just to make it clear for those who might not be drawing the connection, but Jeremiah 31 speaks about a new covenant, and this is the idea that ultimately gives rise to the understanding of a New Testament, which is a different idea, but came from the idea of a new covenant.
Yeah. The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. it will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they broke my covenant. Though I was a husband to them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after the time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness, and I will remember their sins no more. And the difference in Hebrews, I find it here. I should look it up. I'm not
sure. Yeah. So let's just use this opportunity to point out that the text of the New Covenant is actually in Tanakh, in the Hebrew Scriptures.
Okay. Everything's the same pretty much, except I'm going to read verse 9 from chapter 8. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, and I turned away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Here it says, I turned away from them, and in Jeremiah it doesn't say that. That was the difference that I saw.
That's a good point. Does anyone want to take a shot at answering this? No? Think about our class last time. Well, Marcus is pointing out that there seems to be a slight difference in wording between the statement about the new covenant in Jeremiah 31 and then the quotation of that same passage in the book of Hebrews later on. So is there anything that we know of that might explain this?
The desire on the part of people who are not Jewish, but were Christian, to turn aside, cancel out the Jewish content, or to say that they have been put aside by God.
Okay, that's one possibility. I don't think that's the case in this particular passage, but that is definitely a possibility.
Simply a translation difference.
Okay.
You're going from the Hebrew to the English, and now you're going from the Greek, the Jewish Greek to the, or the Hebrew Aramaic to the Jewish Greek to the English. It's being removed more than once.
Right, exactly. You're going through several translations. In this case, probably only two translations with the version that you have. But the author of Hebrews quotes from the Septuagint. Now, I don't have the Septuagint in front of me, but as far as I know, it's quoted verbatim from the Septuagint. So that early Jewish translation, as we mentioned last time, it has peculiarities of its own, and it's not, sometimes it seems to be fairly literal, sometimes it seems to be very paraphrastic or very free in its translation. Again, I don't have it in front of me right now, but I'm pretty sure that the quotation is directly from the Septuagint, so that would explain the slight discrepancy in this particular case. And in most cases in which the writings about Yeshua quote from Tanakh, they're actually quoting from the Septuagint. So they're quoting from a translation. So when you translate something a couple of times, it doesn't always come out exactly as the same as a direct translation.
But you were saying Jeremiah 31 was not from the Septuagint? Was not translated?
No, I think it was translated.
And then the Hebrews quotation was?
No. Greek quotation was. The Greek quotation in the New Testament was from the Septuagint.
In other words, the text that we have of Hebrews
is
in Greek or Jewish Greek.
Okay.
And we don't know for sure that it was originally written in that language, but that's the text that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And in that text, the quotation comes from the Septuagint, which was the Greek Bible of that day. Okay. Any questions please do ask, because usually someone else has the same question if you're thinking of one issue.
For this, these two passages, was that phrase a different phrase? Was it like an additional phrase that wasn't present before, or was it a phrase that is different now from the way it was before?
The wording was a little bit different.
Yeah.
It should have added maybe a sentence or changed, switched the sentence. Really. It switched.
Okay.
I think Jeremiah said something like, even though I was a good husband to them,
yeah.
And in Hebrews it says, and I turned away from them.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Well, let's make a note of this. I don't think we should spend too much time on this particular issue. We're going to see if we have a Septuagint here or not so that we can verify if that's the reason or not. Otherwise, we'll look it up for next time and have a more complete answer next time.
I've studied one verse that has a definite difference in translation in the Septuagint than the Hebrew Bible we have today.
Okay.
It's all based off of whether they interpret the word as Adam or Edom.
Mm-hmm.
It's where the vowels are placed.
Mm-hmm.
The remnant of mankind or the remnant of Edom.
Mm-hmm.
So the remnant of mankind is in the Septuagint, and the remnant of Edom is in the Bible as we know it today.
Right. Thank you for that example. We can keep that in mind just without going into a detailed consideration of the Septuagint. Just keep in mind that there are many passages in which the Septuagint does not seem to be exactly the same as the Hebrew. Or let's say if you are translating from the Septuagint into English, you would come up with something slightly different than if you were translating from the Hebrew version of Tanakh into English. Again, in most cases, they're very similar. But it's just the result of translating from one language to another and then trying to go on. This may come up again in the discussion later on, but I think we should move on a little bit to start to talk about the idea of a covenant and then how that was transformed or perverted into this idea of a testament. In the passage that Marcus read in Jeremiah, it says, "Behold, the days are coming, says Adonai, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah." So this is talking about a specific agreement between God and Israel. This is probably a familiar passage to many of us. And we are actually fortunate to have an understanding of the biblical covenants, of what it means when God makes a covenant, of the understanding of the different covenants that God has made throughout history. But many people have not been so fortunate. And among them, as you read, was John Calvin. And this is on page 41. So John Calvin is, of course, one of the most prominent figures of the Reformation, the establishment of Protestantism. And there was a very interesting point that was made about his fundamental work, the Institutes of the Christian Religion. In other words, his summary of everything that would go into Christianity. And the statement is that Calvin wrote 1.5 million words in his Institutes of the Christian Religion, but did not see any need or any way to discuss God's new covenant with Israel. Now, that's a pretty interesting statement. If you consider that, I think from a messianic perspective, let's say, the new covenant with Israel is one of the most important components of our faith. So it was not one of the most important components for the faith of John Calvin. In fact, it wasn't even a component at all. That's a very significant difference. And part of the reason why the new covenant was not important to Calvin and did not even enter into his system of thought in any way whatsoever is because of the history of this distortion of the idea of a covenant and the growth of the idea of Old and New Testaments, which we'll discuss a little bit later on. It's more than just a semantic issue, in other words. It's not just a question of this label or that label. It's something more substantive. It has more content than that. And the statement in the chapter goes on, "That is because the new covenant being made with the Jewish people could not fit into his Christian religion." And so here when we talk about the Christian religion, again, we're not talking about specific Christians and how they have or have not looked at the Jewish people. Some have looked very positively. Some have looked with hatred. There's been great variety in all of that. We're talking about the system of Christianity that was compared in chapter 1 to the Ptolemaic system of astronomy that preceded Copernicus, or actually held sway, we should say, before the Copernican viewpoint. So in that system of Christianity, in that theological structure, the covenant with Israel was not important. And this raises the question of why not, if it's actually foundational, if Yeshua came to institute the new covenant, and Christianity is supposedly centered around the teachings of Yeshua, how could this possibly be overlooked?
Bias.
Okay, do you want to elaborate?
Nope, just bias.
Blindness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, because he was saying that Yeshua came to save every, the Gentiles and the Jews, wasn't important.
Okay. Possibly that's part of it. I mean, Calvin said a lot of different things, but I think what we could say based on that is that he had a different understanding of what Yeshua came to do than Yeshua himself had, or than the scriptures present. And Calvin was not alone, certainly. Calvin is just one example. If you look at the most prominent figures throughout Christian history, you'd find things that are very similar to this seemingly startling omission by Calvin. And notice also that from within the Christian system, this omission would not really be challenged. It doesn't seem strange from within the system itself. It's only if you get outside the system and look at it from a different perspective that it starts to be so bizarre. Well, I think what we should do at this point is to look at some of the history of how that developed. Why Calvin, in his time, in the time of the Reformation, the 16th century, why he would be in a position to have overlooked such an important element of the biblical presentation. Because to some extent it's not his fault. He was simply following in a long tradition of interpreting the scriptures that had already removed the new covenant with Israel from a place of prominence or even from existing in that system of Christianity. There were a couple of different stages in this process, as you read. It fits in, I guess you could say, with general Christian history that we've discussed already. But the first stage was in the second century, when various Christian thinkers began to use the terms Old Covenant, or Old Diatheke, and New Covenant, or New Diatheke, to refer to portions of the scriptures rather than to covenants, which is what they actually refer to in the scriptures. So again, a covenant, or a brit in Hebrew, is a specific agreement. It can be an agreement between people. Abraham made covenants with people, for example. It can be an agreement between God and a person. It can be an agreement between God and a people. But it's an agreement between two parties. However, in the second century, this concept, or this word, diatheke, which we'll discuss a little bit more later, was used to describe large portions of the biblical text, and the Bible itself was divided into two sections that were termed the Old Diatheke and the New Diatheke. That's the first stage in this process. The second stage, as you read, was in the 4th century, the later 4th century, when the Latin Vulgate was compiled. And at that time, the translation of Diatheke that was made was very misleading. So if in Jewish Greek, Diatheke was used to refer to the Hebrew covenant, the Hebrew Brit, that meaning was completely lost by the time that the Latin Vulgate was commissioned, and instead Diatheke was translated as if it had the general Greek meaning of a testament.
When was the Latin Vulgate made? What year are we talking about?
Well, it says on page 40 that it was begun in 382.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's later 4th century.
It's a national religion in the, say, 330 AD or something like that.
Exactly, exactly. And that's an interesting point. At the Council of Nicaea, Constantine spoke in Greek to try to endear himself to the representatives of the different Christian groups that were there, because the majority of representatives came from Greek-speaking areas, and the language of Christianity at that time was still primarily Greek. With the later establishment of official Christianity and the growth in the western part of the Roman Empire, you have the need for Latin, and Latin becomes the predominant language of Western Christianity. So you have another process which could be looked at in as great detail as the translation from Hebrew to Greek, for example, but you have another process of translation, of translating now from Greek into Latin. And this introduces additional errors, and you can understand why if you think about the fact that it is after the Council of Nicaea, and it is after this whole de-Judaizing of the faith, conscious decision. Remember, Constantine says at the council, "Let us have nothing to do with the murderous rabble of the Jews. We have received from our Savior a better way." So a conscious decision to de-Judaize the faith. And it's in that context that the translation is now made into Latin. So you would only expect that errors would be introduced into the Latin Vulgate. And basically, in a sense, the Vulgate then initiates this long process of mistranslation from Jewish Greek, by reason of not understanding that the language is actually Jewish Greek. So what is the mistake that Jerome makes in the Vulgate in translating diatheke? He makes a few different mistakes because he translates it in different ways at different times. But if we were to simplify, we could say that in translating diatheke as essentially testament in Latin, he translates as if it was a normal Greek word used in the way that Greeks would use it commonly in that society, without regard for the way that it's actually used in the Septuagint, in the Jewish Greek version of the Tanakh, which is clearly the intended sense in the writings about Yeshua. So there are many such examples of this. But if we just take that as one example, we can see, I think, the process whereby the error creeps in. Is everyone clear on this? Am I being too confusing? No? Okay. Any questions? All right. So these are the two stages then in getting to Old Testament and New Testament. First, the division of the Bible into Old Diatheke and New Diatheke, and then the mistranslation of Diatheke as Testamentum, or whatever it is actually in Latin. Yeah, Testamentum. Which carries the meaning specifically of testament. And since it's not a Judeo-Latin that's being composed, there's no reason to assume that it means anything different than testament. Now, the chapter described the specific passage in Hebrews in which diatheke appears repeatedly, and I'd like to look at that, because it basically explains why this was so significant, that the word was mistranslated, what sorts of errors could creep in even in the translation itself. So let's put off for the moment the question of Old Testament and New Testament as names for big parts of the Bible, and let's look at a specific passage that actually uses this word. And this discussion is found basically on, you know, pages 42, 43, and 44. What we could do is look first maybe at the New American Standard translation, which is given on page 44. And if any of you have different translations of the Bible, you might want to open them up too, and we could look at how this passage is translated in your versions as well. But at the bottom of page 44, would anyone like to read from Hebrews 9 in the New American Standard version?
"And for this reason he is the mediator of a new covenant, in order that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. For where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. For a covenant is valid only when men are dead, for it is never in force while the one who made it lives. Therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood.
Thank you. Does anyone see a problem with this? This is, now keep in mind that we've taken it out of context a little bit. We've put it in this book. We've quoted it in this discussion of Jewish Greek and everything, so we can see some of the problems. But the normal person reading this reads it as part of the Bible. They just open up their Bible and they read this. This is God's Word. This is, you know, unmutable, unchallengeable Word of God. But it's actually a translation of God's Word. And that's an essential point. So are there any problems with this statement here?
Several.
Yeah, there's an incongruity between the use of the word covenant and the description. The description is more of a last will and testament rather than a covenant.
Okay, why do you say that?
Because this business about the death of the one who made it, that applies to a last will and testament. It doesn't apply to a covenant.
Right, exactly.
And it says in verse 17 that a covenant is valid only when men are dead, which is completely false.
Exactly.
It's valid only when both parties are alive.
Exactly. And in fact, in the scriptures you can read that if the parties die, the covenant is no longer in effect. Mm-hmm. For example, the covenant of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeshua says that. So exactly. The statement in verse 17, according to this translation, is completely false. It says a covenant is valid only when men are dead. That's not true.
And this version says, for a testament is in force after men are dead, since it has no power while the tester lives.
Okay, let's wait to deal with other translations. We'll complicate it too much. But thank you. Yes, we'll keep that one open. Any other problems with this statement? Well, we can just go through the list of errors that follow the quotation here on page 45. And maybe we'll just go around and read some of these points. You can either just read the bullet point 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or if you're familiar enough with it, you could just restate it in your own words, maybe. So, who wants to start with number 1 on page 45? Okay, Ileana.
It is made by at least two people.
Yes, a covenant is a contract between two parties, at least. It's not a declaration of one person. And if you remember the discussion previously in this chapter, there is an explanation for why translators thought that they could render it this way, and that, again, has to do with the confusion with the idea of a testament. But since this translation, the New American Standard, actually uses the word covenant, we have to assume that they knew what a covenant was. And in a covenant, it's not a solitary declaration. It has to be between two parties, at least. Okay, maybe the next person could read number 2.
If there is only one who makes the covenant, then there cannot be a mediator, which is what Messiah is called in verse 15. A mediator functions between two or more parties.
Right, so we can see that in this translation, we're getting more and more confused about what is actually going on. How can there be a mediator if there's only one person making the covenant? Or one party to the covenant. In other words, if it's actually a testament, a disposition of property and so forth that someone does when they die, it sort of seems similar to that. Why do you need a mediator? Who is this mediator? Number 3.
We go back to Standard Version translation, Hebrews 9:16 is not a true statement. But where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. This is not true. It is not true for God's name, Noah. Neither God nor Noah died to establish a covenant. It is not true of God's covenant with Abraham, nor of his covenant with David, nor of his covenant with Israel. The New American Standard Version rendering is not true for any covenant as it is.
Right, here's another key point, obviously. you have some examples: God's covenant with Noah, God's covenant with Abraham, God's covenant with David, God's covenant with the house of Israel when he led them by the hand out of Egypt. In none of these cases did the someone or the two parties who made the covenant die. So as it's written, the New American Standard translation is false. And if that were an accurate translation, we'd have to say that this is a pretty strange book and doesn't correspond at all to what we know from Tanakh. So either there's a problem with this text, that, and we should be very leery of accepting this text, or else there's a problem with the translation, one or the other. Because it's simply not true that in a covenant, the people who make it die. Number four, we already mentioned another false statement in this translation, that a covenant is valid only when men are dead, for it is never enforced while the one who made it lives. This is the opposite of the truth, as you see there in point number four. A covenant establishes a relationship between the living. If those whom the covenant binds are dead, then the covenant is of no effect. And we won't go into all the details, but some of the discussion that is here in the chapter deals with how, you know, as you get one error upon another error upon another error, it becomes very, very confusing to try to figure out what's going on. And again, keep in mind that most of us and most people read this simply as part of the Word of God and are actually trying to understand what is being said. Well, what's being said isn't true in this case. So that's problematic. Let's skip to number five. I don't know who's next to read.
Hebrew 9:15 okay. Speaks of Messiah as the mediator of the new covenant. That means that Messiah is not the maker of the covenant. He is the mediator between the parties making the covenant. The parties of the new covenant, as presented in Jeremiah 31:31 through 34, Hebrews 8:8 through 12, are God and the house of Israel. The death of Messiah, therefore, would not satisfy the condition of the NASV translation. It would only be the death of the mediator, not the death of the one who made it.
Right, so now here we have one of the consequences of all of these errors accruing. First, we have an inaccurate understanding of what a covenant actually is. Then we have two false statements about covenants that are directly false. And then, in what's supposed to be getting towards the conclusion, we have a statement that contradicts what has already been said, just in the same small passage. So this translation is self-contradictory, as well as contradicting the whole notion of what a covenant actually is and contradicting Tanakh itself and God's covenants in Tanakh. We still have one more, number six. And I guess this is a slightly more detailed point, so we don't need to go into it as much, but it's just making the point that inheritance, again, as a function of a testament, would have been designated by different words. So we know that covenant is actually the right translation, but there are multiple errors in this particular translation. What do you think about this picture as a whole?
It seems like it's hard for me to understand how the translators couldn't see the problem enough to look at it a little deeper. Because, well, this particular translation is later than the other ones in the chapter, where they're using the terms testament and covenant and going back and forth and don't seem to be using it consistently in terms of or translating it consistently.
Right.
So now with this verse, with this translation here, using the terms, like translating the terms consistently, but in such a way that the text doesn't make sense on the face of it.
Right.
Which I would think would like come in and say, you know, wait a minute, what, there has to be a deeper meaning.
Yeah, that's a good point. The other texts actually don't really make sense either, but for different reasons. Here, it's very interesting. They're attempting to be more accurate than some of the other translations that use the word testament. So they recognize that it's a covenant, but they still can't figure out any way to make it make sense. but they did construct something that they thought sort of made sense. They constructed a kind of deferent or epicycle, if you will. You say it seems strange that they wouldn't have gone into more depth to figure out what the real meaning was, but why didn't people before Copernicus go into greater depth? Didn't that system seem strange? I mean, we looked at, I gave you a portion of a diagram, but I mean, think of all these planets and the theoretical orbits that they're supposed to be in, impossible orbits that no one could possibly believe they actually follow. And yet that's the system that everyone believes, to the point that no one can challenge it, and to the point that you will be arrested and your life threatened if you suggest that one should challenge it. So that's the effect of a powerful system of thought. Obviously, in that case, also backed up by, you know, physical force and intimidation. But the same point applies to any structure of thought that attempts to force data into a particular perspective. So I think that's the part of the answer for why the New American Standard translators couldn't even figure out a way, couldn't figure out a way out of this dilemma, because they were in that system. And you can't really challenge, again, fundamental assertions from within a system. We've said this in each class. You know, that's a part of the point of this book, just how people respond to human authority and the systems of human thought, and what the experts are within that system, and why errors continue for so long. I just want to make one quick point, and that's also the power of the tradition of translation, which is something we haven't really stressed. But you can see that choices in translation that were made thousands of years ago, in some cases, or many hundreds of years ago, continue to have an effect. So the modern Spanish translators continue to follow the tradition of how the Greek translation of Hebrew was translated into Latin hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So the power that accumulates from tradition, because they think, well, all of these translators over hundreds of years have done it this way. Mm-hmm. Who are we to say, you know, it's different? It doesn't seem to make that much sense to us, but we're not going to challenge, you know, the entire conception of the universe. And that's a key point, because what happens in these types of systems, whether it's an astronomical system or a theological system, is that the challenge to the overall structure of thought does not usually come from some major issue that we could point to as being of enormous philosophical importance. It comes from the details. What Copernicus did is he just looked at the data, and he said the data does not match up to what's being said. So it's a very minor thing. You know, this planet is supposed to be here, and it's actually not there. And the same thing with this type of a specific passage in the scriptures. If you look at a specific passage, it can end up leading you to challenging the entire system. And I think most people are intimidated by a task like that and would not be inclined to, let's say, challenge the entire system of Christianity that they've grown up with and been taught in, and would instead say, well, I don't fully understand this passage, but that's the way it's been rendered, so it must be correct. I'm just going to follow that. Okay.
I would think that the translations that were done at different times were also done for a certain group of people or with a certain group in mind that would be taught that. Mm-hmm. And so very much like we do today, here to know your audience and phrase it a little different, and that would have had a big impact in how they phrased it. Not just acceptability, but just, you know, being able to present it to the group that it could be understood. And a lot, I'm sure a lot was lost.
Okay, yeah.
I beg to differ with that. For the medieval times, at least, I think that the scribes there faithfully tried to copy what they did. And maybe the stem of the errors are the Vulgate, the transition from the Greek to the Vulgate. I don't know, you probably know a little bit more about that, but if we were to go back to the Jew, to the Jewish Greek, it might read okay, unless there's been errors in copying that, you know, with scribes. And I think that the scribes are pretty faithful.
Right.
But scribes are not translators.
Right. Right.
But I think that the scribes that were working for the kings that wanted to have it pushed, like for the King James or for something like that, because they were coming under worldly leaders that were also religious leaders. I'm sure there was a big influence to make it palatable to the people.
But until the Reformation, there was only Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, and Vulgate, you know.
Latin.
Latin, yeah. Uh-huh. So you have this big span of history with the Dark Ages.
Yeah, certainly in the case of the King James translation, that's true, that not necessarily making it palatable to the people as a whole, but to the political authority, or the political religious authority, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But I think part of what Fred's saying is that this comes actually later than most of what we're considering. And what has arisen in the period before that is a system of translation and a tradition of translation that is very powerful, so that many things would not even be challenged, would not occur to people to challenge them. And other things, if there did seem to be some contradiction, they would simply be passed over because that's the way it's always been done. We could examine this in much more detail, of course, for any possible translation. You could look at every single verse that's ever been translated into any language. This is the general idea, I think, that's relevant here. Maybe we can look at a different translation of this particular passage and see if there are any errors in other English versions, or Spanish if you have that, or whatever version of the Bible you happen to have with you.
This is the New International Version.
Okay.
And it kind of skips between a covenant and a will.
Mm-hmm.
So, should I start with 15?
Mm-hmm.
For this reason, Christ is the mediator of a new covenant, that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, now that he has died as a ransom to set them free from the sins committed under the first covenant. And this is 16. In the case of a will, it is necessary to prove the death of the one who made it. 17. Because a will is in force only when somebody has died, it never takes effect while the one who made it is living. This is why even the first covenant was not put into effect without blood. When Moses had proclaimed every commandment of the law to all the people, he took the blood of calves together with water, scarlet wool, and branches of hyssop, and sprinkled the scroll on all the people.
Okay, anyone see any problems with this? Obviously you see some problems because of our discussion, but anything specific that's different from the other translation? Yeah.
I'm kind of treating the words as synonyms, covenant and will, kind of giving the impression that those are synonyms.
Okay, or actually, it's not giving that impression because all that the person is reading who reads the NIV is the translation. They don't know that it's the same word as was used in Tanakh. So it's actually giving the impression that a completely different concept is being introduced here. It completely passes over the idea of a covenant. And it said, now, that's at the first part. It says it's a will. So in other words, someone's dying and they're disposing of their property or their inheritance. They're passing it on, which is, of course, an erroneous interpretation of the text. So that's the first problem. That's not what's going on in the passage that's described. But they say that it's a will. And then they say that because when someone makes a will, like a last will and testament, they have to die for it to go into effect. That's why Christ, in this translation, which is also a bad translation from Jewish Greek, as we discussed a little bit last time, that's why Christ had to die. And that's also why calves were died to establish an older, I think they say, covenant there.
Right.
Now, there are a couple problems with this. First of all, what in the world would a covenant that was established before have to do with a will now? And secondly, if that other covenant was actually a will, is it the will of these calves? It's the will of the testament of these calves that died? It doesn't make any sense. So it's a very bizarre translation, but if you read it quickly, it sort of seems to make a little bit of sense. There was some sort of something, a covenant, we don't really know what that is, before, and something died, and now there's something like that, a will now, and something died again, so it sort of matches up. But it doesn't make any discernible point or any point that's actually true. Again, this is being perceived as the word of God, but it's completely false, the statements that are being advanced here. There's one other translation that's given in the chapter on page 42, the King James Version. And that's similar. This is where...
That's New King James.
Okay. And we have New King James here, too. On page 42, it's similar, I guess, to the New International Version. It stands at the root of many translations.